Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Norman Mailer lived with his dukes up. He was a slugger, said Louis Menand, after Mailer, novelist, new journalist, public scrapper, died Saturday at 84. He swung at everything, wrote Menand. When he missed by a mile. When he connected, he knocked it out of the park, but usually in there. With The Naked and the Dead, The Armies of the Night, The Executioner's Song, and more, Mailer aimed for literary greatness. But the name Mailer was nearly as famous and often notorious for exploits off the page, the combative, outsized ego, the politics, the boasts, the brawls. He wanted to write the great American novel. Instead, perhaps he reinvented the American novelist. This hour, On Point, remembering the late, the great Norman Mailer. I spoke with Norman Mailer earlier this year about his last novel, The Castle in the Forest, and we will hear excerpts from that interview in this hour. We'll also hear from people who knew him well and followed him closely. We're very grateful to have with us today from New York, Jason Epstein, editorial director at Random House for 40 years and a friend of Norman Mailer since the 1950s. Jason Epstein has worked with such greats as Vladimir Nabokov, E.L. Doctorow, Gore Vidal, and Philip Roth. He was co-founder of the New York Review of Books. He was Norman Mailer's editor for 20 years. Jason Epstein, first, we're sorry for the loss of your friend, and we thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Also with us from New York is Mary Dearborn, author of the acclaimed 1999 biography, Mailer. Mary Dearborn, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom, Jason, and Mary.
Jason Epstein, first to you. You worked so closely with Norman Mailer for so long and was his friend. You were his friend for even longer.
I forget how we actually met, but it was inevitable that we should, because we lived in the same world back in the 50s.
Do you remember him in those 50s and what you first made of this ball of fire?
Well, he made me nervous in the 50s, because he and I are quite different in our public behavior, at least. And though I admired him, and I think we were friends, I tended to keep my distance in those days. I had no interest in drugs or violent politics or anarchism or whatever it is he was promoting at the moment. But we formed a friendship nevertheless. It was a strange friendship because of the cultural differences between us, but it persisted until Saturday.
And after all those decades and all those books, many of which you edited yourself, and we'll talk about it in detail, but the headline from your corner, what have we lost with the loss of Norman Mailer, Mr. Epstein?
Pardon me?
What have we lost with the loss of Norman Mailer?
I think the best comment I've heard was from Jim Walcott in his blog, that it's as if a planet had disappeared. I couldn't put it better than that. And I think that's the feeling I have, and I think maybe most people would have. I mean, something enormous has disappeared from our lives.
Mary Dearborn, he was so explicit, sort of boldly, almost madly explicit about his ambition. It takes a lot of courage to be so explicit about his ambition, to be right up there with Hemingway, Faulkner, Tolstoy, you name it.
Well, I don't know whether he's up there with Hemingway or Tolstoy or whoever, but he's up there. There's no question of it. And I think it will persist. I think it will go through phases the way these things do, but he will always be there as a writer to be reckoned with.
Mary Dearborn, how do you see that legacy and whether or not, you know, Norman Mailer was able to deliver on his own very publicly announced ambitions?
Well, Norman certainly was ambitious. Anyone who writes a book called Advertisements for Myself obviously is. That was a wonderful book. It was a self-promotion, beautiful sort of rant about his ambitions, and he sized up what he called the talent in the room, that various other writers, and he was very nasty.
This is in the late 1950s. He'd written the Armies of the Night, and then had some trouble with his follow-up books. This was his desperate attempt to get back into the limelight, and it succeeded.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And he announced, you know, watch me, what I do next. And that's why you get a controversial essay in Advertisements for Myself called The White Negro. Norman was very, he liked to provoke. He liked to push the boundaries and see how much he could get away with. He was very much a feisty boxer and headbutter.
His point in The White Negro was to laud hipsterism. That is, I'm the white Negro. I'm the hip guy. And why was hipsterism so important to him, being hip, Mary?
I don't know. I mean, it was definitely misguided. It was a time in his life where he was trying to act, Jason said, violently, and I think that's correct. He was in violent alliance against the status quo. He was he wanted to be, yes, a hipster, but a hipster was something, it was not nice. It was maybe even criminal. He praised criminals in that essay for their bravery.
The violent, those who acted through violence. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. It was the most provocative thing that anyone has done, I think.
But I think
it's a real achievement, though.
We'll look at that. But at the end, you in your biography and your remarks since then, are willing to give him that kind of status. If Hemingway owned the first half of the 20th century, you say, Norman Mailer, with all the competition out there, might be said to own the second half.
Well, I think I said that Hemingway was the most important writer of the first half of the century, and Mailer as of the second half. And notice I don't say best. I say most important. I think his existence had an impact that's different from the impact of his creative output. I think he exemplifies the age in a lot of ways.
His existence as in his very public existence, his celebrity,
yes.
His persona is almost as important as his work.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Hemingway sort of had celebrity thrust upon him. I mean, the media wasn't there yet to record his every move, but he liked it. They both responded in complicated ways. Now, Norman set out to create his celebrity status. He was a real celebrity status of the media age.
Jack Beatty, Mailer said, hip is the sophistication of the wise primitive in a jungle. That would be Norman speaking of himself.
It would be. And Jason, I add my sympathy as well. You know, he was the writer as prophet, the writer who's reaching beyond the quotidian, what we can see, the daily, and trying to find some ultimate level of significance. He was fond of quoting William Blake, and he reminds me of Blake's comment, if a fool persist in his folly, he be wise. And sometimes he didn't quite make it to wise. He stayed in folly. I mean, some of his ideas, repression causes cancer, violence is this existential gesture. His whole depiction of sexual relations between men and women as a kind of warfare. All this seemed silly and worse sometimes, downright pernicious. And yet he could take the most ordinary and banal of details and make it live. That quality he used a word once, enlifement. There was such enlifement in everything he wrote. And here, if I may, is a passage where he talks about excrement. Now, I'll clean it up, but it's amazing. He said, the food you ate yesterday was too rich for you, says the odor in the water closet. Eat as improperly today, and you will be ill. But this is much too simple. Say, rather, that the senses bring deep messages to the unconscious, quick, deep messages, and they are measured carefully by the scale of past experience. A carpenter makes 100 measurements a day. If you ask him to mark off 5 inches without a tape, he is bound to be able to do it within an eighth of an inch. So it is with our stool. Our senses know what it says to us, but so often the messages are intolerable. You are sickening slowly, remarks the ward. Your life as you lead it now is hopeless. You must engage death, perversion, promiscuity, and the fear of hell before you will be better. Your health is to eat the body of your mate. Your secret desire is to be trampled in an orgy. That is what the oracle of the unconscious made divine from the feces.
Let's let Norman Mailer speak for himself for just a moment. I spoke with him in February of this year about his book, The Castle in the Forest. I have to say, I loved talking with Norman Mailer. Here he is. It's, of course, a fictional account of Adolf Hitler's childhood. The narrator is the devil. I asked Norman Mailer if he believed in the devil.
Well, I certainly believe in God. I don't believe in the God of the fundamentalists, the God who's all judgmental, who's all good and all powerful. I consider that absurd, finally, for reasons I'm perfectly willing to get into. I believe in a God who's a creative God, who's doing the best that he or she can do against great odds. And when you start to speak of great odds, why do I say great odds? It's because nothing is easy in this existence. We have exaltation in this existence, and we have despair. And I think that is the measure, in my mind, of the conditions in larger places, in the universe as a whole. The universe is something being formed all the time. And so there are forces that fight each other. And I would personify some of those forces by speaking of the devil. Yes, absolutely.
Norman Mailer, On Point in February of this year. Jason Epstein, that's only a handful of months ago, and he was so vigorous and lucid on that day. Was that the case and,
yes,
to the end?
It was. Well, he was. You could see that he was failing. He couldn't move around. He could hardly see. Mm-hmm. His birthday party last winter.
His knees were shot, for one.
His birthday and his wife's about on the same day, and they had a joint birthday party, and Norman couldn't stand up. He ran in his seat all through that party, which was a clue to something. He was obviously running down. But toward the end, his performance was amazing. You know, when I heard that quote from him about God, what he's really talking about is a metaphysical version of himself.
We're talking this hour about Norman Mailer, brawling, sprawling man of letters, novelist, new journalist, American provocateur, dead on Saturday at 84. I've been joined by Jason Epstein for 20 years, his editor. He's editorial director at Random House since the 1950s, a friend of Norman Mailer. Mary Dearborn joins us. She is author of the biography, Mailer, A Biography, came out in 1999. She's also done biographies of Henry Miller and the philosopher John Dewey. Jack Beatty's here. He championed some ideas that were out there. Here he is in an interview with the BBC's Terry Wogan talking about violence. This is a couple of decades ago, undated, but it sounds like the 70s, maybe early 80s, talking about violence in society.
There are people who hate violence, but you can't legislate individual violence out of existence. I'm not even sure you can legislate international violence out of existence. But I've always felt the two are at odds with one another, that the less individual violence there is, the more likely there is to be a state violence.
The less individual violence, the more state violence. Mary Dearborn, talk about provocative. What does that champion?
Well, it's complicated. Mailer called himself a left conservative, and people don't know what to make of that, and I don't know what to make of that. But I do know that he was president of Penn, for example, and he asked for an international conference. He asked the Attorney General, George Shultz, to talk to the group. And this was considered...
to this group of authors. And George Shultz, of course, not exactly left at all.
No. And the people in Penn were shocked and outraged. He called the conference, he called the name of it the imagination of the state. As some people pointed out, the state doesn't really have an imagination. But he defended himself. That was, again, he's being provocative. It's maybe less exciting than some of the provocative things he did in the 50s and 60s. But he was still out there. I think at that point, and the culture was geared this way too, power was of great interest. It's a Reagan White House. And I think Mailer was attracted to power, and he wanted to get someone near the top to speak.
There's the issue of power. There's the issue of the state, and he could be very provocative in his interpretations there. Later, he looked at issues of spirit. We talked with him about those, and we talked about the castle in the forest. Let's hear a little bit more of that. This is again from February of this year. Norman Mailer explaining why he believed in reincarnation.
I'm a great believer in reincarnation. It's the only thing that makes sense to me. The notion that we go through all we go through, you know, we all lead such curious lives, so full of good deeds and ugly, clumsy deeds, foul deeds, sour deeds, noble deeds. There's such a mixture of good and bad in all of us that the fundamentalist notion that you go either to heaven or to hell has always struck me as absurd. You know, to think that suppose your moral nature is 53 good, 47 bad, and lo and behold, you go to Club Med and you're basking in some sort of heavenly sun for the rest of existence. Or if you're on the contrary, if you're only 47 good and 53 bad, there you go into the fires of hell and burn forever. It strikes me as being absolutely nonsensical in relation to God's needs. God created our existence, our universe. For God, as a creator, what's important is that the creation be maintained and developed and grows. And so reincarnation strikes me as very sensible from God's point of view, because he could take those of us that he's not quite satisfied with, his early creation, so to speak, and send us back again, and perhaps improve on learning from us. He can improve on that creation.
Norman Mailer with us at On Point in February of this year. And Jason Epstein, I mean, there he is again. That's what, 5 or 6 months before his now, sadly, his passing, and the ambition of what he wants to grapple with, just as high as one can imagine.
Well, if that remark is addressed to me, let me tell you, his original idea was to write a 7-volume novel about Hitler, of which The Castle in the Forest was only the first. And originally, before he added a new ending to it, he left Hitler at about the age of 12. Later that year, he cut the 7-volume plan down to 3, so he must have seen that his powers were waning. That was the first indication that something was probably going seriously wrong with him.
He was still at work on a 2nd volume, I believe, at the time of his death. Will we see that? How far along is it?
I didn't see any of it, and normally I wouldn't until he was about finished. He keeps those things to himself. Norman was a pleasure to edit. He would take seriously everything I said and said, I'm really going to think about that. You've got a good point. I'm glad you did that. And then he would come back, and it's clear he had paid no attention to anything. So he's his own editor, really. He doesn't need an outside editor. But toward the end, he took on the largest subjects. Hitler, of course, which is a vast subject that no novelist has touched. God and Jesus. Those are his last three preoccupations, literary preoccupations. That tells you something about his own sense of himself and where he fits.
I want to hear from our listeners on Norman Mailer. Let's turn to Todd in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. What do you know?
Well, I read The Executioner's Song, which is my first Mailer novel, about 10 years ago when I was 25, living in San Francisco, you know, just out of college, and it really changed my life.
This, of course, the story of Gary Gilmore, the convicted murderer on death row, who asked to be executed by the state of Utah in 1976. How did it change your life, Todd?
Well, I think prior to that, I might have been considered a Hemingway fan, living in romantic notions of life and the character as bigger than, you know, the situation. And it sort of jolted me out into sort of a reality that was new to me. And then the second portion that you just noted, with Gary Gilmore wanting to be executed and all of these other constituents from the government to civil rights activists and such coming in to try and save him, and who ultimately controls one's life, and are the parties of, say, the federal government, the state government, the activists, what are their interests, and why do they presume that they know what's best for the individual?
It was a big, ambitious take on a famous headline right from the news. Mary Dearborn, what took Norman Mailer to the story of Gary Gilmore? Why was he drawn to it? What did he hope to find there?
That's a good question. He romanticized, in a way, Gary Gilmore. He wanted to be like him. He was an outsider. He was he did the opposite of what culture expected you to do. You know, you're supposed to protest being executed. And I think Norman saw a real saga in Gary Gilmore. And The Executioner's Song is a wonderful book. I mean, it's just, it's very evocative of the American West. It's really, Mailer really found a new voice when he wrote that book.
And a voice that carried that West right in it. Let's go to Harry in Ayr, Massachusetts. Harry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I guess this is perhaps the reaction of many people to Norman Mailer. That my reaction to Norman Mailer would have been that he was a bloviating, self-absorbed, intellectualizing person whose ideas, things like his notion of a sense of verbal pollution, just never hung together, except that I read The Naked and the Dead before I ever knew who Norman Mailer was, and it was probably the most incredible book I ever read.
Remind us why. It's a long time ago for people who haven't read it, Harry, or haven't read it for decades.
Well, I haven't read it for decades.
Yeah.
But it, just the profound sensitivity, his crystal clear perception of people in battle, which I understand, I may be wrong about this, that he himself was not in, it wasn't that autobiographical. It was, my understanding is anyway, that a lot of it was simply his way of understanding battle.
He was called up to the Army in the spring of 44, pretty late in the war, went to the Philippines, didn't see much combat, was a cook in occupied Japan, but he did have this famous single patrol on the island of Leyte, which people cite as the raw material. What was that sensitivity? What did he tell you about war that you didn't know, Harry?
I think he told me almost everything about war that I didn't know. I had never been in war and never have been in war, and it just was a gripping story of men and men in combat. I think he understood men very well, probably better than a lot of other writers. But I just, if it hadn't been for that book, I think I kept wanting him to live up to that book, and to me, I guess it's my own problem, but to me, he never did. He never lived up to that book and what I saw of him after that.
Harry, stick with us. Jack, here was Norman Mailer. He was 25 years old when this came out. Kid from Brooklyn, Jewish kid from Brooklyn, goes to Harvard, giant ambition right off the bat, and with his very first outing, he's a superstar. He's a literary superstar straight out of the war.
Yes, and I think he felt, or at least in writing about him, you see that he did, that there was a falling off in the 50s, that he couldn't quite get back to what he had in that experience. But, you know, that novel, and in my memory of it, too, is distant, but it also engages not just the war, but ideas about fascism, and about fascism as domination, as one man ruling another. His character, Sergeant Croft, as I recall, is a kind of, if not American fascist, then somebody that type. And he understands there are people who submit and there are people who rule. And he sees that not as just something that happens in the world and world politics, but in the platoon, on the patrol, in ordinary life. So he takes, to compare it, say, to James Jones, Thin Red Line, which is just really about, really, it's a wonderful book, but it's about a battle and combat and so on. This is battle, combat, but also these big ideas that are involved in the world struggle at the time that he catches in the personality, that he presents in the personalities of the men.
Jason Epstein, take us forward from that war, World War II, that really made Norman Mailer's name so early on, to by the end of the 60s, he's marching outside the Pentagon, he's writing The Armies of the Night, still obsessed maybe with power, but looking at it from a very different angle this time.
Well, you have to remember that Norman was larger than life. He was more than a writer. He was a performer of his own life. And he became a kind of literary celebrity out on the edge. That's where much of his reputation came from. He lived up to it. The Armies of the Night was a masterpiece. Many people think, and I agree with him, that was his most important work, or at least his most successful. But Norman was a public figure, and he was taking chances that other people wouldn't take, that other writers couldn't take. I have to go back to what I said earlier about what he undertook to do toward the end of his life, write those books about Hitler and God and Jesus. Who would think of that? That's taking enormous risks with the subjects that other writers haven't succeeded with.
And he was prepared to do it, and to do it again and again. Harry, thanks very much for your call. Let's take a call from New York City. Mel is on the line. Hi, Mel. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about another aspect of him. When I was a young graduate student at the University of Connecticut, he gave a lecture in a lecture series, and after the lecture, There was a party for all of the graduate students and him. And I had said that in the class that I had said that I thought Barbara A. Shore and his other books before on The Naked and the Dead, mm-hmm. you know, were really not nearly as good. And so he came over to me, he smiled, and he punched me hard right in the stomach.
You were a student? You were an undergraduate?
I didn't get it. He said, oh, you're the wise guy that thinks he's so smart, huh? And went, boom.
Wow.
I was, like, completely shocked, you know, the son of a gun.
Well, that's what you call engaging with your readership. Mary Dearborn, what was that about? It wasn't the only time. I mean, he famously stabbed his wife with a penknife. Here he punched Mel for criticizing his... He'd go into a Duke's up position when he met book reviewers, critics on the street.
You're lucky he didn't ask you to headbutt. He liked headbutting. I think being pugnacious was part of Mailer's... Constitution. And he did. He had famous battles with Gore Vidal, with Truman Capote, with other writers. He persisted in writing these essays in which he sized up the talent. You know, so that James Baldwin, I think he said, smells of toilet water.
Too much perfume.
Looking
at his sexuality, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think Norman was kind of prejudiced by that. But no, it was very like him. And I guess the implicit thing was that he was ranked up there with them. Hemingway did the same thing. He would say to his editor, Max Perkins, Jason's predecessor, he would say,
Well, let's listen to just a little bit of you mentioned it, but here he is in 1971 after he published The Prisoner of Sex. Gore Vidal criticized the book as sexist, and that same year, Mailer went on The Dick Cavett Show to criticize Vidal. You know, here's just an example of sort of Mailer doing his thing.
I'd really like to get into a discussion with Gore. He's been saying absolutely unspeakable things about me. He's been acting even worse than he usually does as a polemicist. You know, he's really, he's shameless in intellectual argument. He's absolutely without character, a moral foundation, or even intellectual substance.
Okay,
I mean, the perfect proof of what he does is that Leave It to Gore to write a play about Richard Nixon. You know, I'm getting to the point where I'm going to end up liking Nixon.
Norman Mailer going after Gore Vidal in the early 70s, and yet Jason Epstein, you write about how, at least in his later years, this was a very sweet man with a very large extended family from his many marriages and many children.
Well, let me add a footnote to that. Gore, whom I know well, admired Norman. He did take a poke at him, and Norman took a poke back at him. But there's no question that they admired each other. What happened, I think, is that Norman married Norris, and
Church, his last and long-term wife.
That was his last marriage. It lasted about 35 years, and it was a wonderful, wonderful marriage. Norris is terrific. She's a strong, sensible, kind, talented woman and parent. And the headbutting soon abated, and the belligerence and all of that bellicosity seemed to peter out. And he became a very gentle, loving family man, surrounded by his children, on good terms with all of them, devoted to Norris and she to him. And a different Mailer, a kinder, gentler, older, wiser Mailer, emerged from all that. Which is not to say that his writing became placid.
We're talking today about Norman Mailer, brawling man of letters, novelist, new journalist, American provocateur, dead Saturday at 84. We're joined by Jack Beatty. Mary Dearborn, his biographer in 1999, is with us from New York, and Jason Epstein, editorial director at Random House for 40 years, Norman Mailer's direct editor for 20 years, friends with Mailer since the 1950s. We're joined as well right now from New York by Pulitzer Prize-winning author, longtime columnist Jimmy Breslin. He was Norman Mailer's running mate in his unsuccessful but very widely covered 1969 run to become New York's mayor. Jimmy Breslin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Very good. How are you, Tom?
We're good. What have we lost in losing Norman Mailer, Jimmy Breslin?
A working person. When you mentioned Mailer, I was just talking with somebody about it. I only think of one thing, the Van Gogh's work boots, that painting, that which illustrates to me working for a living. And that's all he did. He worked. These other stories about his behavior are incidental, not worth mentioning half the time to the amount of work he did.
I mean, just the sheer output. Mailer at the typewriter, at the keyboard, year after year.
A lot of times writing longhand.
Longhand, no kidding.
Yes, wrote longhand a lot.
Those are long books to write longhand.
Yes, long thing.
What were you up to with Norman Mailer?
The ideas come off the pages like sparks spitting out of a fire. I mean, he was a working man, and he thought. And he left thoughts to a country which has transposed, which has taken truth and turned it into one truth that they could use for killing people.
Who's they?
Who's they? Look at Washington. Look at those people. The Protestants. What do you think they are? Bush, how's that? Bush drinks non-alcoholic beer on a plane that Air Force One swallows it until he can't even move, and then he goes home, and you know he starts on the alcohol then. The synapses in his speech show you that the man has got hardening of the arteries from drugs or whiskey.
Jimmy Breslin, did you stay close to Norman Mailer? Not everybody did at the end of his life.
Why wouldn't you? Yeah, I spoke to him a lot. Why not?
And how do you think he looked back? I mean, he was so bold early in his career with his ambitions. How do you think he looked back on his own career?
I don't know. He kept working.
Yeah.
I don't know how you start to look back on your career. You're looking to tomorrow. You're looking at one thing, too. You know, they always don't think about bills.
Right.
You got a right for money to pay bills.
A lot of wives and a lot of kids and a lot of alimony.
You don't dream of what happened 20 years ago or something. I got Con Edison tomorrow.
He ran for mayor of New York. You were right there with him on the stump, and you recall the Times report. You said later you realized you were running with Ezra Pound.
That was one night. There they go again. We had one night out at a time and went to the Village Gate. There was a big crowd. It was a campaign rally of some kind. And he stumbled on reality a little bit. We were screwed up from drinking 2 p.m. Senator's wife, Marion Javits, she didn't help. And we got to the gate, and he started to scream at the crowd. They're there to clap for him, and he's insulting them. And at which point I left. I went home, and I called Jack Dofield up, who set the thing up, and said, "You've got me running with Ezra Pound."
Was he serious? Did he want to be? Did he think he might be mayor of New York?
Well, he never did a thing that wasn't serious in his life. And the mayor of New York at that time, you had a guy, Procaccino, running. Did Norman kept grousing, "I can't get my hands on a brain this small." Procaccino's. I mean, come on.
It's great.
And, you know, within the octave of that night that they're still talking about in Friday, he got a Pulitzer Prize for the armies of the night. So, and I had a book out with a title, "Can Anybody, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight."
Right.
They got carried out on that title for the last 50 years is probably the one or two most used in newspapers over stories.
Jimmy Breslin, are they going to be reading Norman Mailer 50 years from now, 100 years from now, to understand 20th century America?
Not? That's why he did it. Of course it'll be bad. Why not? What are you going to read? What's his name? Kerouac? Jack Kerouac is the other one they give a lot of publicity to. He taught a generation of Columbia students how to write a run-on sentence. That's his contribution to history. They don't know what's important. Mailer was very important.
Because
he worked. He was a working man.
He was indeed. Jack Beatty, Jimmy Breslin tells it from the Breslin Corner, as always, and he sees the work boots here.
Yes.
He was a working man, and I gather in his house in Brooklyn Heights, he had a kind of like a Captain Ahab. He went up a gang, he somehow got up to the top of this building, and it was like Captain Ahab on his bridge.
Yeah, it was nice. He also was mostly in Provincetown in the last.
Yeah, of course, he had a house there. I remember sitting down for lunch in Brooklyn Heights a few years back at one of those very crowded sidewalk cafes. Here comes a guy on two canes, plops down right next to me. It's Norman Mailer, just out for lunch. What are you going to do? You're in New York. Jimmy Breslin, we know we've only got you for a couple of minutes. We're grateful to you for joining us. Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Jimmy Breslin. Let's go to Milton in Hampton, Virginia. Milton, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
We're well. What do you know, Milton?
Hey, I have just one comment or actually a question. I'm with the guests. Norman's relationship with Muhammad Ali back in the fight in Zaire with Foreman seemed like it was pretty close. I'll get off the line and listen.
Great. Mary Dearborn, remind us of that book and that relationship, Ali and Mailer.
Oh, I'm so glad it came up because the fight is, I think, a gem, an undiscovered gem in Mailer's work. He's able to look at himself. This is also true in Armies of the Night. He was a huge egotist. There's no doubt about it. But he was able to make fun of himself, to turn irony on himself. And the fight in Zaire called the Rumble in the Jungle, Norman was energetically followed the training leading up to the fight. You can see this in the film, The Fight, where somebody said, Mailer's just, you know, being interviewed, but somebody said he should have got an Oscar because he jumps out of his chair showing what he did when Ali was throwing the last punches. It's a very, very good book, and it's very funny, and I think it's a valuable look at that moment.
We heard on NPR this morning the bit of tape where he goes out running with Ali in the morning. Ali outruns him and leaves him running in along the road in Zaire in the dark. He hears a lion, and he imagines the lions that didn't get Hemingway may get him, and it turns out it's just a lion in the zoo.
Okay. No, that's right. It was right next door. And also, one thing... About God and the devil and what Norman felt about them, I think it's no accident that he went out. He has a book on the shelves now called On God, and it's really just interviews with Michael Lennon, I think. But I think he's just superstitious enough that he didn't want to go out having written about the devil. I think, you know, he's a big believer in magical thinking. In Zaire, for instance, he had a balcony on his hotel room, and he decided that he had to walk the length of that balcony on the railing, and if he didn't do this, then Ali would lose. You know, all of us do it somewhat. You know, if I leave the room during the baseball game, my team's going to score, or not going to score.
But walking the railing is that takes it to the edge. Lynn is calling from Charlestown, Massachusetts. Lynn, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I just wanted to speak to the comment earlier about how Norman Mailer had mellowed after his marriage to Norris Church. I went to see him last February when he gave a talk promoting his latest novel in Cambridge, and when he came out to the stage, here's this little old man tottering out on two canes, and I thought, oh my God, this is Norman Mailer. But he sat in his chair and sort of gathered up himself and became Norman Mailer, and it was wonderful. And as the presentation went on, it seemed as if he was less interested in discussing his new novel and much more interested in engaging the audience in discussions about the state of the world. And someone asked him about something about what people's impression might be of him later on, and he said, well, I never was as macho as I thought I was.
He was so present in February. I know exactly what you mean, Lynn. And I loved hearing the same thing. While we've still got time, I want to run a little more tape from just that time. This is Norman Mailer. Same time you were hearing him, Lynn, within that handful of days, he spoke with us February of this year. Jimmy Breslin raised politics. Norman Mailer went there as well, talked about democracies and relationships, talked about democracy in America under George W. Bush.
Well, I keep hoping that this country becomes a greater democracy, not a lesser one. What people don't realize about a functioning democracy like America is that it democracy has an element of love in it, a love of one's fellow human being that's crucial to the continuance of democracy. And love is an emotion. When two people are in love, that relationship either improves or deteriorates. There's no such thing, or let's say the rarest thing in the world is to find two humans who love each other at the same level for many, many years. No, there are periods where they love each other more, and there are periods when they love each other less. And the saddest thing about love, and the most dangerous thing about love, is love can turn to its opposite. It can turn into corruption, it can turn into hatred, it can turn into a sourness of spirit. Not everybody is enlarged by love. Some people are diminished. Same is true with democracies. When you have a democracy, that democracy has to grow and prosper and develop, or it's likely to turn into worse. A democracy is a fragile democratic growth. It's no accident that it only came into existence in the last couple of centuries. And it's very important that a democracy, as I say, develop in a fine fashion rather than a sour, bad fashion. And I think this democracy has been deteriorating, not crucially yet, but still deteriorating for the last 10 years, and certainly has not gotten better while Bush has been in. He's injured it. I'll even go further. I think that the leader of a democracy, it's very important that such a leader speak the home language well. It's important because people take their cue from the President of the United States. Right. And if he speaks beautifully, speaks well, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, people are enlarged and their intelligence develops. Whereas if you speak in cliches all the time, like George Bush, you are doing your best willy-nilly to render the populace a little more stupid.
Norman Mailer with us in February of this year. Jack Beatty, there's a man very much engaged in his 84th year.
Yes, and what an imagination there. He takes this this analogy between love and its seasons, and if it doesn't expand, it contracts and goes sour, and then he brings it to democracy. I mean, that is, you know, and you're watching, you're listening to that, and you're thinking, is he going to be able to land this thing? And by gosh, he does land it. It does make sense. He's on the wing with that thought. And I think that was so true about everything. I've seen him speak, you know, at lectures and so on. He would take a thought and push it to its extreme. And sometimes you'd feel, my God, you're hovering in folly. But he would keep on going and land wise more often than not. And I think that's in a way the message of Mailer. Live,
you know,
the adventure of the sentence, the adventure of your life. Don't give up halfway. Push it through. I really think he gave that. He incarnated that in everything he said.
He said, "I don't think life is absurd. I think we are all here for a huge purpose. I think we shrink from the immensity of the purpose we're here for." Beth is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just have a little quick story about the early 60s and running into Norman Mailer just by an accident. I was walking my dog. We had...
Were you in New York, Beth?
On the street, New York City.
Yes.
On the Lower East Side, and I think it was around Houston Street somewhere. There's a man weaving around, standing in the middle of traffic, waving his arms crazily, kind of stumbling, kind of staggering, which in New York you don't pay a whole lot of attention to, but in this case someone said, "That's Norman Mailer," I think. Well, at about that time, a police car came to a grinding stop, and Mailer, who it did turn out to be, walks over and goes to open the passenger side door. Policeman, which was locked, policeman got out, came around, pulled him over the sidewalk. Mailer's there weaving, and the policeman's saying, "What are you trying to do?" And Mailer said, "I'm trying to hire a cab. I want a cab. Take me home." It just went on. It was almost like, yes, this man was never intimidated by anyone.
Make the police car into a cab if that's what it takes to get home.
The policeman got more and more incensed. He finally heard Mailer say, "This is Norman Mailer, and you might as well take me home." At that time, there was a huge crowd around. The flashers are still going, and, you know, people are laughing. And I think someone who knew him came along and kind of rescued him at some point. Everyone wandered off.
Beth, it's a great story, and we're grateful to you for sharing it. Thank you very much. Jason Epstein, you work with a lot of greats and have worked with a lot of greats. What kind of hole does Norman's passing?
What kind of what?
Hole does he leave for you in your life, in your work?
Oh my goodness! Well, I said before that I was quoting Jim Walcott, who said that the planet had disappeared, and I haven't been able to deal with it yet. But there's a hole there; you can be sure of that.
Do you see that kind of ambition still in a new generation of novelists, or is that something unique to his century, the 20th century?
Well, I have to add that he was also a dear friend. I didn't think of him in the larger terms that we're discussing here. He was a guy that I knew well and cared a lot about, and I went to see him in the hospital about 2 weeks ago, and for all purposes then he was dead. He had tubes and pipes coming out of everything. He could barely recognize me, and after he did, he just subsided back into his sleep, and I sat there for an hour and he wasn't saying anything, so I left. But it'll take a while for me to deal with that. It's hard to answer your question.
I understand. And so comes the end of a great, great life. And when he was alive, he was very alive. Jason Epstein, editorial director at Random House, longtime friend of Norman Mailer, thank you very much for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Mary Dearborn, author of Mailer, A Biography. Mary, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being here, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.